Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we are doing something a little bit different. Usually, you know, we take a big topic, AI, supply chains, something like that, and we just tear it apart from every angle. But today, I want to invite you into a time machine.
I like this idea. A time machine.
Yeah, I want you to just close your eyes for a second, unless you're driving, of course, in which case, please, please keep them on the road. But imagine it's January, and not just any January. It's January 1972.
Okay, so a very specific place, a very specific time.
Exactly. And you're 19 years old. You've just stepped off a plane in a country where, you know, the sun stays up all night in the summer. But right now, in the dead of winter, it barely rises at all. The world is just this perpetual twilight of gray and white.
And you're hearing a language that is completely alien.
Completely. The language surrounding you sounds like nothing you've ever heard. It's not German. It's not French. It's something else entirely. And the temperature. It is about to drop to 40 degrees below zero.
That really creates a mental image. We're transporting ourselves to the Finland-Helsinki mission in the early 1970s. And I love this concept of a time capsule episode, because we aren't just analyzing history, are we? We're trying to inhabit the lived experience of these specific people.
That's it, exactly. We're looking at a specific window of time, roughly 1972 to 1974. And our source material for this deep dive is this fascinating collection of memoirs titled Seven Memories and Miracles.
And these are firsthand accounts.
100%. Huh. Written by the missionaries who were actually there, boots on the ground, or I guess I should say bikes on the ice.
And what stands out immediately about these accounts is the texture of the experience. I mean, this isn't a high-level theological discourse. We're not going to be breaking down scripture verses today.
Yeah, not at all.
Instead, this is a gritty, on-the-ground look at young people navigating a foreign culture during a very specific era of post-war recovery and, you know, modernization.
That is the vibe we're going for, the rustic reality. We're talking outdoor toilets, we're talking dangerous dogs, rumors of the CIA, and the incredible resilience, what the Finns call sisu, that was required just to survive.
Sisu is such a great word to anchor us. It doesn't translate perfectly, does it? It's sort of stoic determination, grit, bravery, and resilience all wrapped into one.
Yeah, it's a feeling as much as a word.
And for you listening, whether you have a background in missionary work or not, this is really a case study in that kind of resilience. It's about how shared hardship creates lifelong bonds and how awkwardness, I mean, extreme painful awkwardness, is often the gateway to connection.
So let's unpack this. We have to start with the arrival. You know, usually when you travel abroad today, you've got Google Maps, you've got Uber, you have a translation app that speaks for you. These guys had none of that. They were just dropped into the deep end.
Thrown in.
One of the contributors, a man named Mark Meadows, describes his arrival as a literal shock to the system.
And he's referring to the physical shock of the cold, right? I mean, it's the first thing that hits you.
Yes, but it's the specific way he describes it that just gets me. He talks about stepping out into negative 40 degree air in January of 1974. And, you know, negative 40 is that magic number where Celsius and Fahrenheit meet.
It's just cold. Yeah. No translation needed.
It is just objectively dangerously cold. And he says it was the experience of, quote, walking through your own breath.
Wow. That is a visceral description.
Isn't it? He explains that the moisture in your breath doesn't just, you know, dissipate. It freezes instantly in the air right in front of you. So you're literally pushing through a cloud of your own frozen exhalation as you walk.
It sets the stakes immediately. This isn't a vacation. It's a survival situation. You're battling the elements from the absolute moment you step onto the tarmac.
And sometimes that survival situation started before they even got to their assigned apartment. There's this story from Earl J. Price. He's transferring cities, trying to get from Lockheed to Sinajoki. It's the middle of the night. He misses his train.
Oh, that's a classic travel nightmare. Even in the best of conditions, that's rough.
Oh, it gets so much better. He finally arrives in Sinajoki at midnight. He has no cell phone, obviously, no way to call anyone, and zero idea where to go. The mission office is closed.
So what do you do?
What do you do? He spends the night in the train station. He describes sleeping on a rock-hard wooden bench, sandwiched between two, as he puts it, slightly inebriated gentlemen.
And that is quite the welcome to the country. But it also just highlights the independence required of these young men. They were thrown into the deep end. Mm-hmm. You either figure it out or you freeze.
Right. And when he finally finds his companion the next morning and they go to the apartment, it's not exactly the Ritz-Carlton. The street name was Rotatikatu, which literally translates to Railroad Street.
So on the wrong side of the tracks, basically.
Literally. And Earl describes the apartment as austere.
Austere is often a polite way of saying rough.
Very rough. They lived on the bottom floor of a two-story house. There was no refrigerator. It's a hot plate. But the real kicker was the bathroom situation.
Oh boy.
They shared a toilet with the host family, the emmente, the landlady, and another tenant. And this toilet was temperamental.
Temperamental how? What does that even mean for a toilet?
It had one of those high tanks with a pull chain, you know, the really old school style. But apparently the mechanism was ancient. You had to pull it with the precision of a safe cracker to get it to
So it
flush.
was a puzzle.
A puzzle. If you pulled too hard, nothing. Too soft, nothing. Earl admits that on more than one occasion, he completely failed to make it work. He could not get the toilet to flush.
That is a very distinct kind of panic, isn't it?
Imagine the humiliation. He had to go find the landlady, this older Finnish woman, and ask her to come in and pull the chain for him because he couldn't do it. You're this representative of your faith, you know, wearing a suit, trying to look dignified, and you have to ask for help flushing the toilet.
That really speaks to the humility required in this lifestyle. You show up thinking you're there to teach and lead, but you can't even handle the basic plumbing without help from the locals. It just levels the playing field so fast.
It does.
It reminds you that you're a guest in their world, operating by their rules, and you are not in control.
And speaking of plumbing, or I guess the lack thereof, we have to talk about hygiene. Because if you're picturing a nice hot shower every morning to warm up from that negative 40 degree weather, you need to think again.
Right. Many of these apartments in the early 70s, especially in rural Finland, did not have showers. That was a luxury item.
Earl describes their morning routine. He calls it the daily bucket run. It involved taking a bucket to a sink upstairs, filling it with water, and hauling it back down just to wash their faces and brush their teeth.
Wow.
It was manual labor just to get ready for the day.
It emphasizes how much energy was involved just in existing. Before you even knock on a door, you've already had a workout just washing your face. But they did have a bathing routine, didn't they? It just wasn't a daily thing.
Oh, yes. Saturday night was sauna night. And look, this wasn't an electric sauna at the gym where you sit for 10 minutes after a
At
workout.
least this is the real deal.
This was a rustic, wood-fired backyard sauna, no electricity. You sit in the heat, you sweat, and then you wash by dipping a bucket into a big tub of hot water and literally dumping it on each other's heads.
It's a very traditional Finnish experience. In fact, the sauna is almost a sacred space in Finnish culture. It's where you get clean, of course, but it's also where you bond. It's a social ritual.
It is, but it definitely came with its own hazards.
Right.
There's a story about Veli Monsen. Veli means brother, by the way. That's what they all call each other.
Right.
So Veli Monsen decides to do the traditional thing and roll in a snowdrift to cool off after being in the intense heat.
Which is invigorating and potentially dangerous if you're not careful.
Extremely. So he runs back inside, feet wet with snow, steps onto the smooth wooden floor of the changing room, and boom, he slips and crashes right into the hot sauna stove.
Ouch. That sounds serious. A wood-fired stove is basically a giant branding iron.
Yeah, he got a bad burn. And here's where the language barrier turns a medical emergency into a complete comedy of errors. His companion, Earl Price, is frantically flipping through his Finnish-English dictionary trying to find the word for burn
Of course.
so he can tell the landlady what happened while his companion is just sitting there in agony.
That scene perfectly encapsulates the missionary experience in that era. You have high stakes, you have physical danger, and you have a dictionary standing between you and any kind of solution.
Absolutely.
But I think it's important to zoom out a bit here. You mentioned the rustic nature of these apartments. This isn't just a funny anecdote. It really reflects the broader context of Finland in the early 70s.
So.
Well, Finland was modernizing rapidly, but it was still deeply recovering from the wars. In the big cities like Helsinki, sure, you had modern amenities. But in these more rural towns where the missionaries often served, life was still very traditional. The lack of refrigeration, the wood-fired heating, this was normal life for many of the locals.
Right, they weren't being punished. This was just life.
Exactly. So by living this way, the missionaries weren't just observing the culture from a distance. They were embedded in the struggle of it. They weren't staying in a holiday inn and commuting to the hardship. They were living the same bucket-run life as their neighbors.
That's a great point. It forces a kind of empathy you just can't fake. And part of that life was dealing with the elements. We've touched on the cold, but we really need to go deeper into the physical grind. Because it wasn't just cold, it was aggressively hostile to human life.
It brings a whole new meaning to frozen assets.
It really does. Gary Wahlquist records riding bikes in temperatures ranging from negative 22 to negative 49 degrees Fahrenheit. Let me just say that again. negative 49. That's minus 45 Celsius.
At those temperatures, machinery fails. I mean, metal becomes brittle, grease freezes solid, your bike chain would probably just snap.
And yet, they're on bicycles, single-speed bicycles, no less. Gary describes the visual. He says they looked like Arctic explorers. They wore fur hats, scarves wrapped all the way around your faces so only their eyes were showing.
A little slit to see through.
A little slit. And because of their breath freezing, their hats and scarves would be covered in this thick layer of white frost. He said they looked like Yetis in suits.
It's an intense image. Just these two young men, covered in frost, pedaling through the dark twilight.
But they had a secret weapon against the wind, and this is one of my absolute favorite details in the entire source material, the Book of Mormon holsters.
I was hoping we'd get to the holsters. Please, explain the engineering here. This is fascinating.
Okay, so picture a harness made out of green plastic fabric. It goes over your shoulders and has a pocket under each armpit, like a detective's gun holster, but for books.
Okay, I'm picturing it.
And they would carry a standard 1-inch thick finished Book of Mormon under each arm.
That's practical for carrying materials, sure. Keeps your hands free for the bike handlebars.
But Gary points out the secondary, and perhaps more important, benefit. When you are riding a bike directly into a freezing headwind, those two thick books acted as windbreakers.
No way.
Yes. They protected your vital organs from the wind chill. He says, at least our sides were always warm.
That is Finnish engineering at its finest, or at least missionary adaptation at its finest. It's using the tools of the trade for literal survival.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, while the cold was a very real physical adversary, there was another presence in Finland at that time that was much heavier, much more pervasive.
You hinted at the shadow of war earlier.
Yeah. This is the part that really grounds the time capsule concept for me. Wow. We're in 1972, 73, 74. World War II had ended about 30 years prior.
Which seems like a long time to us now, looking back. But in the scope of a human life, it's nothing. The adults these missionaries were meeting, people in their 50s and 60s, they had all lived through it. They had survived the Winter War and the continuation war against the Soviet Union.
Exactly. The missionaries had a nickname for the elderly widows. They called them mumis. These were women whose husbands had died in the war or passed away in the years since. And they were everywhere.
A whole generation of them. Gary Walquist describes them in their black winter coats, using kick sleds, you know, those sleds you stand on and push with one foot, to get their groceries home because it helped them balance on the ice.
It just paints a picture of a society with a gap, a missing generation of men.
And the men who were left, the men over 50, were almost all veterans who had fought off the Soviet invasion. These weren't just guys who had served in the rear. They had fought for the very existence of their nation.
They had seen things these young missionaries couldn't even imagine.
And they carried it with them. Gary Walquist tells this incredibly powerful story about his landlord, his aisante. This man had been a prisoner of war in a Russian camp.
That's a harrowing experience. I mean, the survival rates in those camps were just incredibly low.
He told the missionaries that the daily ration in the camp was 300 grams of soggy bread. That's it. For the whole day. He went from weighing 156 pounds down to 99 pounds. He was basically a skeleton when he finally got out.
My goodness.
And this is the detail that just sticks with me. This landlord and his friend made a pact in the camp. They swore to each other that if they ever got out, if they survived, they would never ever go hungry again. They would never complain about food, and they would never let themselves starve.
Wow. That context changes everything about the interaction, doesn't it? When a missionary knocks on a door and that man answers, you're not just talking to a contact or a potential investigator. You are talking to someone who has looked death in the face, who has survived starvation. It explains that hard shell that missionaries so often describe in the Finnish people.
Right. It's that sisu again. It's that grit. The missionaries were battling the cold weather, which is hard enough, but the people they were talking to had battled for their actual existence. It creates this very profound emotional backdrop to all of these stories.
And it suggests that the rejection missionaries faced wasn't necessarily personal or even theological. These people had survived bombardment and starvation. A couple of American teenagers knocking on their door might just seem trivial in comparison.
Trivial. Or, considering the geopolitical climate, even suspicious.
Or suspicious. Which brings us to a very different kind of hazard. We've talked about the coals. We've talked about the war trauma. Now let's talk about the dogs.
Ah, yes. The natural enemy of the door-to-door salesman, the mail carrier, and apparently the missionary.
Always the dogs.
Gary Walquist has this story he titles Entering the Lion's Den. He uses this very biblical language to describe it, which just makes it even funnier. He talks about a German shepherd behind a see-through picket fence.
The fence you can see through is almost worse because the dog sees you coming from a mile away. You can't sneak up on it. The tension builds.
Exactly. He says the dog was gnashing its teeth exceedingly. The lady of the house eventually invites him in, but she just puts the dog on this flimsy-looking rope, and they have their discussion at a picnic table in the yard. But the whole time, the dog is just waiting, staring at them.
Waiting for the release. It turns the lesson into a hostage situation.
Pretty much. And as soon as they stand up to leave, the dog starts lunging. The lady has to physically hold it back by the collar. Gary and his companion are backing out of the gate, trying to maintain eye contact, and just as they latch it clank, the dog breaks free and slams into the fence at full speed.
Oh, man.
Gary says the dog let them know in no uncertain terms that it desperately wanted to rip us to shreds.
It's a primal fear. But there's another story that's almost funnier. Scott Perkins tells one about his companion, Roger Nuttall.
Right. Roger had already been bitten.
Yes, he'd been bitten by a dog and was proudly showing off the stitches in his hand. You know, a war wound. So they're walking later, and another dog, a big German shepherd, comes bounding towards them, barking.
And what did the veteran do?
He bolts. He just turns and runs away, leaving his junior companion, Scott, completely alone.
That's amazing.
Scott says he just froze and held his briefcase up like a shield, waiting for the attack. Luckily, the dog just ran past him. But the image of the guy with the stitches running away is just perfect.
It's so good. But there were times when the fear went the other way, where the locals were afraid of the missionaries. And this connects right back to those Book of Mormon holsters we were talking about earlier.
Yes. The CIA rumor. This is hilarious, but it also touches on that Cold War paranoia that was just simmering under the surface.
So remember the holsters carrying the books under the armpits? Well, one day, an elder is in a public bathroom washing his hands. He's taken his suit coat off for a second, so he's just there in his white shirt and tie. And this harness with two dark rectangular bulges under his arms.
To the uninitiated, or to someone who has seen way too many spy movies, that looks exactly like a shoulder holster for a pair of pistols.
100%. A local Finnish guy walks in, takes one look at this American with what looks like guns under his arms, turns around, and flees the bathroom in terror.
And you can just see how the rumor starts and spreads from there. I saw them in the bathroom. They're armed.
Exactly. It fueled this persistent rumor that the Mormon missionaries were actually undercover CIA agents, which when you really think about it is the worst cover story ever. Our plan is to wear name tags and knock on every single door in the country to maintain our secrecy.
It's brilliant. But in the context of the Cold War, with Finland sharing that massive border with the Soviet Union, people were on edge. Helsinki was a known hub for espionage. Spies were a real thing there. So seeing two young Americans with holsters wasn't just funny. It played into the real geopolitical anxiety of the time.
That is a great point. Paranoia was part of the atmosphere. Now, speaking of hazards and accidents, we have a very specific account from the archives that we want to share with you. This is a story about a bike incident written by a missionary named D. Child. And we're going to read this exactly as it was written in the source material. This is a story of a bike incident written by D. Child. One spring day when I was a new missionary, a month or so before you and President Wei became our mission leaders, I was riding my bike down the quiet street following my great senior companion. I was studying a missionary lesson as I rode and held up the little lesson booklet in one hand while I steered the bike with my other one. In those days, I rode a standard bike with only one gear and we did not wear bike helmets. I was looking at my lesson booklet while also trying to watch the road, which was a bad idea. I ran right into the back of a small car that was parked along the edge of the street. I hit it so hard that I flew up in the air over the bike's handlebars and clear over the top of the car. I landed on the ground on my feet in front of the car. I was not hurt at all. My front bike tire was flat, my rim was bent but still functional, and the front fork of the bike was bent straight back, but I was just fine. I know of missionaries who have had different outcomes to similar experiences, and I don't know why I was spared the way I was, but I am grateful for that miracle. Now, moving from the hazards of the road to the hazards and the joys of the stomach, let's talk about food.
Food is always so central to the missionary experience, isn't it? Largely because you're burning an insane number of calories biking in the cold, and you're usually on a very, very tight budget.
And in the Finland-Helsinki mission under President Robert G. Wade, there was this major policy shift regarding dinner. Originally, the missionaries cooked for themselves in those rustic apartments we talked about earlier, but there were rumors, some disturbing rumors.
Like the famous can of peas story.
The very same. Rumor had it there was an elder who, to save money, was eating nothing but a single can of peas for dinner every single day.
That is a recipe for scurvy, not for success. It's also incredibly isolating, just sitting alone in your apartment with a can of peas.
Right. So President Wade made a rule. Missionaries had to eat dinner. It was about nutrition, sure, but it was also about efficiency. Stop wasting time cooking and cleaning. And this led to the era of the bari.
Now, for you listening, a bari in Finland isn't exactly a bar in the American sense, is it? It's a bit different.
No, it's more like a cafe bar hybrid. They served alcohol, yes, but they also served cheap, hearty food for the working class. It was a community hub. And Gary Walquist breaks down the standard menu. The staple was panu pivi.
The meatloaf patty.
Yeah, basically a hamburger patty or a small meatloaf topped with a fried egg, served with a massive scoop of mashed potatoes, and this is crucial, pickled beets.
The breakfast of champions, or dinner in this case, a very solid calorie-dense meal.
And the cost, 4 Finnish marks, which at the time was about $1.
A dollar. You can see why it became the go-to. It's calorically dense, it's affordable, but I think beyond the calories, eating in the Barracks really changed the social dynamic of the mission.
Totally. Instead of being hidden away in their apartments eating their sad can of peas, they were out in public every single night. They were rubbing shoulders with the locals, including the town drunks and the working class folks who were just getting off their shifts.
They became part of the local scenery.
Exactly. Gary mentions that at first the locals were suspicious of them, but eventually they just became part of the furniture. It normalized their presence in the community.
It broke down that otherness.
Yeah.
They were just the American guys eating potatoes like everyone else. It's a subtle form of integration.
But of course, they were still young guys, and they had their own rituals and inside jokes to keep things light. We absolutely have to mention the ice cream rule.
This is a great insight into how they coped with the constant biking accidents. You have to gamify the pain, right?
You have to. Mitch Butler tells this story. The rule was beautifully simple. If you wiped out on the ice while riding your bike, you owed your companion an ice cream cone.
High stakes litigation on the ice. I love it.
So Mitch describes this one night where they'd just had a fantastic family home evening with a family, really spiritual, high connection, everyone's feeling great. They leave the house on top of the world. They start riding down the family's steep driveway. And both of them lose control on a patch of ice.
Gravity comes for us all. It doesn't care about your spiritual high.
Not at all. They slide right across the road and crash into a snow-filled ditch right in front of the investigator's house. They have to crawl out, covered in snow, and wave back at the family like, we're okay, everything's fine.
Oh, the embarrassment.
And then Mitch realizes, that's 2 ice cream cones we have to buy.
It's those little rituals that keep morale up. If you can't laugh at sliding into a ditch, you're just going to cry. But we have to address the biggest hurdle they faced. It wasn't the ice, and it wasn't the dogs. It was the Finnish language.
Oh, the language. Every single account mentions it. Dreadful, shock to the system, impossible. These are the words they use.
And for good reason. Finnish is notoriously difficult for English speakers. It's in a completely different language family. It's not Germanic. It's not Latin-based. The grammar is incredibly complex, with something like 15 cases for nouns. It's a linguistic fortress.
And these missionaries, these kids, were trying to memorize entire discussions phonetically. They were just repeating sounds. They didn't even know what the individual words meant half the time. This led to what they called the college professor problem.
Which was what, exactly?
The formal Finnish they memorized from the books was very academic. It was high, theological, almost archaic language. So you have these 19-year-olds showing up at a door, sounding like a 60-year-old linguistics professor from the 1800s.
And that would sound bizarre to the locals.
Bizarre. It creates this immediate distance. You aren't speaking the language of the heart. You're speaking the language of the textbook. It's like someone walking up to you on the street and speaking in Shakespearean English to ask for directions.
It's just not how people talk.
And sometimes the tools they used to try and bridge that gap just backfired completely. Gary Walquist tells this great story about the flannel board.
Classic Sunday school tool.
Mm-hmm.
For those who don't know, it's a fuzzy board where you can stick paper figures on it to tell a story.
So they're in an investigator's home teaching a lesson. They've got the flannel board all set up. It's on this flimsy easel. They have the figures on it. And the investigator's cat gets curious.
I see where this is going. This can only end one way.
The cat decides to attack the board. Poof. The whole easel collapses. The figures, Jesus, the prophets, the temples, they fly everywhere. The cat runs off terrified. The spiritual mood is completely destroyed.
It's hard to recover this spirit when you're on your hands and knees picking felt figures out of the carpet while the cat is hissing in the corner.
But the best stories, the ones that really capture the struggle, are the major linguistic mistakes. Gary Carter shares an absolute classic. He's talking to an older woman, a widow, and the Finnish word for widow is leski.
Leski. Okay, I've got it.
But the Finnish word for fat is leski.
Oh, no. A vowel shift. A tiny, dangerous vowel shift.
A very, very unfortunate vowel shift. So the woman mentions that her husband has passed away, and Gary, trying to be empathetic and connect with her, says, oh, so you are fat then.
That is every language learner's worst nightmare. How did she react? Did she throw him out?
She burst out laughing, just started roaring with laughter, and she said, yes, I am. It completely broke the ice. Gary says it actually led to a better, more genuine connection than if he had said the right word perfectly. It humanized him.
That's such a profound insight, isn't it? We often think that to persuade or to teach, we need to be perfect. We need to be the authority figure with all the right answers. But so often, it's our vulnerability, our mistakes, that allow people to trust us.
Yeah, that's a great way to put it.
It showed her he was trying, and it allowed them to laugh together. It leveled the hierarchy. He wasn't the perfect American teacher. He was just a kid trying his best and failing hilariously.
The redemption of the mistake. I like that. Now, all of this, the resilience, the language learning, the physical grind, it didn't happen in a vacuum. It happened under specific leadership. And the central figure in almost all of these memoirs is President Robert G. Wade.
He seems to loom large in everyone's memory, a real defining figure for that era of the mission.
He really does. He took over when the mission was small. It was down to about 60 missionaries, and his big goal was to rebuild it, to get the numbers up and prepare for the creation of a stake. But his methods were really interesting. He didn't just focus on baptize more people. He focused on character.
He was building the missionaries, not just the mission.
Exactly. Earl Price talks about the Franklin technique that President Wade taught them. It's taken directly from Benjamin Franklin's autobiography.
The 13 virtues. Yeah, that's a famous self-improvement method.
Right. Franklin would pick a virtue like silence, order, frugality, and he'd focus on mastering it for an entire week. President Wade had the missionaries do a daily version. Pick an attribute, say, charity, and for that one day, your entire focus is on being the most charitable person you can possibly be. Then the next day, you switch to honesty.
It's a brilliant psychological tool. It breaks down the overwhelming task of being a better person into a manageable daily game. It's not be perfect forever. It's just today, I have to be honest. It builds a habit of mindfulness and gives you a specific target to hit each day.
And he coupled this really practical advice with deep spiritual promises. Morgan Hendricks tells a story about his first interview with President Wade. Morgan was really worried about his family back home. Some of his siblings had gone astray. Family members weren't active in the church.
That's a common worry for missionaries. You feel so helpless being so far away, completely unable to influence what's happening at home with your loved ones.
President Wade looked him right in the eye and made a promise. He said if Morgan served faithfully and gave his whole heart to the work in Finland, he would witness miracles in his family. And Morgan writes that it happened. During his 2 years, family members returned to the church, spouses were converted, temple sealings happened.
That connection between the service rendered in the field and the blessings received at home is a core tenet of missionary faith. But having a leader explicitly promise it to you and then seeing it fulfilled, that anchors a young person's faith for life. It validates the sacrifice.
It's powerful stuff. Now, we can't do a time capsule on Finland without talking about the natural wonder of it all. We've talked a lot about the cold and the dark, but we haven't talked about the light.
The aurora borealis.
The northern lights.
The northern lights. Burke Rees and Reed Finlay have these descriptions that are just poetic. They talk about one specific night, February 19th, 1973. Burke says the colors rushed to the center of the sky and exploded.
Exploded. That's such an energetic, violent word for it. It's not just a gentle shimmer.
He says the whole sky was a giant movie screen of color. Red, green, yellow. And you have to remember, these are kids from Utah, from Idaho, from Arizona. They have never seen anything like this in their lives. Reed says they honestly wondered if it was some kind of heavenly manifestation.
In a way, for them, it was. It's a reminder that they're in a special, almost magical place. The deep isolation of the Arctic brings with it these moments of sublime beauty that you just can't get anywhere else. It's the cosmic reward for enduring the cold and the dark. And alongside the visual beauty, there is the auditory beauty. Music played this huge role in bridging the cultural gap.
Music bypasses that college professor language problem we talked about. It speaks directly to the emotion. even if you don't understand the words.
Exactly. Byron Taylor talks about being assigned to compile a bunch of Finnish Christmas songs, Joulupukki.
Which is Santa Claus, right?
Yep, Joulupukki, Joulupukki. They would go into retirement homes and hospitals and just sing for people. Gary Carter mentions that even if they didn't understand every nuance of the lyrics, the feeling was there. It was a way to give service when they couldn't communicate perfectly with words.
But music cut both ways, didn't it? It could connect them to the Finns, but it could also connect them to what they'd left behind. It could trigger some serious homesickness.
Oh, the trunked out story.
And trunked out is missionary slang for being so homesick you've basically mentally packed your trunk to go home.
Right. That's the one. Gary Walquist describes sitting in a barre with eight other elders. They're all eating their meatloaf, laughing, having a good time, and suddenly the radio in the corner starts playing Yesterday Once More by the Carpenters.
Oh, that is a nostalgia bomb if there ever was one.
Every shalalala, he says the entire table just went silent. Every one of them stopped eating. It instantly transported them back to their girlfriends, their cars, their high school dances. It's just this powerful reminder of how young they were. They were kids, thousands of miles from home, trying their best to be men.
That is such a human moment. The contrast between the Carpenters on the radio and the harsh Finnish winter outside the window, it highlights the sacrifice. They gave up those shalala years to be there.
So as we wrap up this time capsule, let's try to synthesize all this. We've looked at the frozen breath, the war widows, the angry dogs, the grammar mistakes, the northern lights. What's the big picture?
It creates a portrait of a crucible. Paul Sharman, one of the contributors, actually uses that exact word. He calls the mission a crucible for learning patience, discipline, and charity.
And Jerry Olson talks about how 50 years later, he still relives these experiences on his knees when he faces challenges. They're still with him.
And that's the key, isn't it? Why do these memories persist half a century later? It's because the difficulty was the teacher, the sisu, that Finnish grit, it rubbed off on them. You don't get that kind of deep character growth sitting on a comfortable couch. You get it when you're doing a bucket run for water at 6 a.m. in the dark.
You get it when you're slipping on a train station bench.
Exactly.
It brings up a really provocative thought for us today, I think. We live in a world that is obsessed with comfort and efficiency. We have apps for everything. We have heated seats in our cars. We have instant translation on our phones. We avoid discomfort at all costs.
We optimize the friction out of our lives. We view difficulty almost as a failure of technology, something to be engineered away.
Right. But if you look at these men, their character was forged in the friction. It was forged in the cold and the awkwardness and the hunger. So the question I'm left with is, what are we losing by making our lives so efficient and so comfortable? Does deep character growth require a bucket run equivalent? Do we need to be cold and uncomfortable to really learn who we are?
It's a question worth asking. Maybe we need to find our own Arctic to explore, even if it's just stepping outside of our personal comfort zone a little bit more often. Maybe we need to embrace the rustic reality occasionally to remind ourselves of what we're actually capable of.
Something to think about next time you turn up the thermostat. Thanks for diving deep with us into 1970s Finland.
Edos, thank you.
We'll see you next time.